So, Matt, I think I mentioned a while back, I barely got out of Chile right when the lockdown for coronavirus began. I was very fortunate to get out, very fortunate to go and return safely in the first place. But one thing I noticed is that Chile, like many places in South America, has militarized its police force.
That sounds familiar. Yeah, it's definitely something that has been happening in the United States for quite a while. And for the past few years here, we've been discussing as a nation, what the heck do police departments really do, you know, for communities in which they operate? And back in 2015, we asked that question and we made this episode. I'm interested to know how you know, see this conversation changing since we recorded this episode. So please listen to it and give us your thoughts.
From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Greetings. Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
And I'm Ben. We're here with our super producer, Noel Sirenson Brown, which means that this is...
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
Oh, good. Okay. Yes, we're in the right place, and hopefully so are you, ladies and gentlemen. Matt, quick story. When I was younger, when you were younger, I guess we were all younger if we're talking about the past, there was a show on television, which I think might still be on, called Cops.
Yes. Cops Reloaded now, I believe. Maybe not. I know I've seen that somewhere on the TV Guide.
And as a kid, I had this superstition that if ever I sang the theme song out loud, something bad would happen.
Like you would summon police or criminals?
I'm not too clear on it. Again, I was a kid. Something bad.
Okay.
And it's something that I've stuck with today. Now, I'm not bothered, of course, if anybody else is singing around me or if I hear it. But as ridiculous as I know that is intellectually, there's still just a little part of me that hesitates because I, like most people in the United States, want absolutely no problem with police officers or cops.
Absolutely. I have a quick story.
Yeah?
So the house that I live next to, I take my dogs out in the backyard. We have a little fenced-in area. And I noticed that the house just next to mine, the back door to the basement was wide open and the lights were on. This is around 11 o'clock at night when I noticed this. And I didn't think too much of it. You know, maybe they're airing out the basement. Maybe someone's just working. And so anyway, I just went back inside. Well, for the next three nights, I noticed that it was in the exact same state when I would take my dogs out. And I started getting a little worried. You know, what if somebody in the house, you know, fell or something and got hurt while they were cleaning, you know?
Yeah.
So I ended up calling the police department. And it was the first time I've actually called the police department. Because I was a little nervous, I don't know if you would have been nervous, but I didn't want to just walk into my neighbor's home to check and see if everything is all right.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't do that unless I knew them pretty well.
Well, maybe in the past, I probably would have, especially if I was a bit younger. Uh-huh. But now, for some reason, maybe it's just the amount of television shows I've watched with police investigations. Like, I didn't want my prints to be in the house, like my footprints or anything to be in the house in case anything bad had happened.
Or if there was a crime scene to do anything to compromise it.
Like, I was terrified.
Yeah.
So I called the police and they came and they looked at the house. But I have to admit, I felt really tense when the police officers were there.
Was it, what did they find just out of curiosity?
I have no idea. I didn't stick around. They dealt with me very coldly.
Sure.
And I don't know. It was an experience that I don't know that I would do it again. I would probably find the homeowners association or whatever it is. There isn't one where I live, but something to that effect.
And I don't think you could call 911 to report something suspicious. It would have to be an emergency or like a crime in progress.
Yeah, and I had no idea what the state was. But
right. Well, I hope things worked out. Did someone live at that house?
Someone did, but I think they were tenants, and they moved out.
Okay. Well, maybe it was a squatter or something.
Yeah, who knows? I have no information. But anyway, I just wanted to reiterate my uneasiness that I felt even calling the police.
Mm-hmm. And there have been generational attitude changes toward law enforcement. Now, whether you think that is a result of changing laws or incarceration rates, or whether you think that's just something in pop culture, the zeitgeist, either way, it is true that people have changed their opinions. And today we are talking about a topic that has been on people's minds for a number of years recently, and in particular, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're also going to find that this is part of something that dates far, far back in American history. What we're talking about today, ladies and gentlemen, is law enforcement and race. And before we jump into a bunch of statistics and stuff, I want to make sure that people know this is not a podcast intended to take pot shots at police officers, many of whom die in the line of duty.
Absolutely,
right?
Not. I can't remember if you have any law enforcement in your family, but I have some in my family, and this is nothing against law enforcement officers in general at all.
Right. What we're talking about more today will be the larger trends, mm-hmm. the statistics, and possibly the future. So, Matt, let's just start off with some stats, huh?
Okay. According to the 2010 U.S. Census, 13.6% of the U.S. population identifies as African American. That's less than one-fifth of the United States population as a whole.
And when we did our video on five frightening statistics about being black in America, we started with that as number one, which doesn't sound that scary by itself, but
yeah, it just gives context for these other numbers that we're going to be throwing out here.
Right, because we also found that despite being a smaller segment of the population or a minority part of the population, African Americans in general are disproportionately more likely to
be detained, arrested, or even prosecuted for a crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least 70 departments, police departments from Connecticut to California arrested black people at a rate 10 times higher than people who were not black or not African American. That's according to USA Today.
And here's a statistic from the ACLU that we found. Marijuana usage, cannabis usage, is roughly equal among white people and black people. However, black people are 3.73 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession.
And if somebody is arrested for a crime, right, and prosecution goes forward and they are convicted, then, well, let's say that you have two friends, Joe and John.
Okay.
And one of them is white, one of them is black. They both get caught doing the same crime, both get convicted. Statistically, the African-American defendant will have a longer, harsher sentence.
According to the Wall Street Journal, prison sentences for black men were nearly 20% longer than those for similar crimes for white men.
Mm-hmm. And the Wall Street Journal, to be fair, is not what you would consider a tree-hugging, super liberal,
right?
Abolish money, close all prisons kind of, I almost said rag, but it's a well-respected newspaper.
That's right.
Record. And then we have more from the Sentencing Project. Studies that examine death penalty cases have generally found that in the vast majority of cases, if the murder victim is white, the defendant is more likely to receive a death sentence, no matter who they are.
Wow.
In a few jurisdictions, mainly the federal system, minority defendants, particularly black people, are more likely to receive a death sentence in general. So what we're seeing here, and of course these are not fully fleshed out studies in a lot of ways, but what we're seeing here is that the identity of the person convicted or suspected of the crime seems to be having an impact beyond the actual letter of the law for a crime and a punishment, right?
Yeah, and even the identity of the victim.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is troubling stuff. I know that in recent years with like the Trayvon Martin case, with Michael Brown, mm-hmm. And numerous other instances, the American public became surprisingly divided. And people were saying, well, this has become some sort of liberal or conservative cause and started, I don't know. It's strange how quickly things can divide a public, right?
Yes. And both of those are very specific cases mm-hmm. with things that you can analyze. And a lot of times it seems that those two cases in particular, at least recently, have been used to try and paint a picture of this overall thing.
Of a larger thing. And of course, Matt, you and I are not lawyers.
No.
Well, Noel does a lot of stuff. Noel might do some law. I'm not sure.
Maybe. He strikes me as someone who could definitely hold it down in a courtroom.
So Noel does just a touch of law. Between us, we are like 0.3 lawyer.
But, nice.
But the reason we're saying that is that we're not here to try to force our own opinion Mm-mm. on people, and I hope that we can both do a good job. I'm preaching to myself here. I hope we can both do a good job of separating our opinion from our facts. And speaking of facts, let's look at some more.
Another thing we can look at is the likelihood of imprisonment for males, and this is again from the sentencingproject.org. 1 in 17 identify as white. So if you identify as white, you have a 1 in 17 chance of being in prison. If you identify as black, you have a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison.
At some point in your life.
Yeah. And also 1 in 9 for men overall. So if you're a man, you have more than a 10% chance of being in jail at some point.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening. And that's throughout the United States. That's an average that takes in everybody from the top 1% of income to, you know, the bottom and below.
It makes me, I was going to say a person, but it makes me want to follow every rule as closely as I possibly can to avoid mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. There's another thing here. We'll talk about the police shootings. So, despite being 13.6% of the population, African Americans, people who identify as African Americans, comprise about 26% of reported police shootings, and they are not the most likely group to die in the course of like a police arrest or detainment.
No, this was a very surprising statistic that you found, Ben. The most likely part of the population in the U.S. to be killed by police are Native Americans.
Right, yeah, that's 0.8% of the population, but 1.9% of the police killings. And these are based on not the best numbers.
No, but it's, you know, a lot of these numbers actually aren't based on the best information out there because we don't have that information. We, you know, John Oliver talked about this. We've heard this before. The tracking of killings mm-hmm. by law enforcement is not up to snuff, currently at least, from a federal level.
Right, yeah. We found that federal databases that do track use of force or arrest-related deaths by police are painting a partial picture. You know, you'll have the FBI has a justifiable homicide list, mm-hmm. right? And the Department of Justice has a couple of different databases that they maintain. Police departments, individual police departments, and again, these can all be very, very different within the state, you know, not even considering what one state's kind of police department mm-hmm. approach would be to another one. In terms of record keeping, of the 17,000 roughly police departments across the United States, many don't report or haven't filed mm-hmm. reports for these things or have filed them inconsistently. And it kind of goes back to the question, you know, is this some sort of purposeful effort or is this something like another mountain of paperwork and people
yeah.
have to actually go fight crime, you know?
You and I are no strangers to just piles of work that you have to get to. And I can only imagine what that must be like. You know, you need to track everything that happens within your police department at all times. Every single police officer that's out on the street has to make records of what they did that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine just what that must be like to tackle, at least from a managerial perspective.
So if the question is the black male part of the U.S. population more likely to go to jail, to be killed in the course of an arrest, or to have a harsher sentence than someone else, then the answer is yes. There is clear racial disparity in various factors of law enforcement, and this is not a controversial thing to say.
And it's not a new thing at all.
No, and it's noticeable today in New York, San Diego, Las Vegas, the percentage of black people killed by police was at least double that of their share of the city's total population. That's a study by a group called Color Lines. And we'll talk more about that after a quick word from our sponsor.
But there is a silver lining here, if you want to call it that. The number of police killings or violence by police officers has dramatically decreased since 1960. According to the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, the police killings of African Americans over the age of 25 has decreased by 61% since then.
And this is such an interesting and kind of disturbing thing. I do agree that it is, what was your phrase? A silver lining, but it hasn't dropped to zero.
Yeah, and absolutely, 61% is not enough. however, it's when you take into context the way this stuff is reported on sometimes, that number to me was at least a bit, made it feel a little less like there's a dark cloud and it was kind of moving away slightly.
Well, going, and also considering that this number accounts for the 60s, you know, in the civil rights movement, there was probably also a spike in violence.
Okay.
So that might be part of it. You know, earlier we said that someone identifying as African American has a one in three chance of going to jail for something at some point in his life. That to make it a little more immediate, a black male born in 1991 in this country has a 29% chance of going to prison at some point. That's compared to 16% for Latino or self-identifying, and for white males, 4%. So there's a clear disparity here. And, you know, when we first started looking at this, you know, we were concerned because we didn't want to be out there vilifying an entire organization or even lionizing a group of people. Like, people commit crimes and people can be corrupt because they're people, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll talk some more about the state of police and the government and the people that the police and the government are supposed to be working with and for. Which has also changed. We talked about this in SWAT teams. But first, for anyone who has not heard this yet, if you're listening to our show, then we assume you already kind of knew about this. But let's have a word about incarceration in the United States.
Okay, well, as many of you know, the United States of America is a world leader when it comes to incarceration. We've even branched out to, you know, putting foreign nationals in jail as well.
Sure. Yeah. Black sites across the planet.
Chicago, anybody?
The Chicago, which I think that was a dark site for local protesters. Yeah.
Maybe.
Who knows? Guantanamo, of course. And, I believe that the private prison company CCP is looking to branch out into creating, immigration holding centers.
Yeah, they want to expand. Oh man, I was going to come up with some euphemism for business, but I'm not even going to go there. That CCP, if any of you don't know, CCP is one of the topics that we've covered before in the past, and I highly recommend you check out some of our videos on, I forget exactly what the titles are, but there are some of our classic videos on incarceration and
privatization of prisons.
That's exactly what it is, privatization of prisons.
So we know that it's weird because we're looking at this, and I don't want to make light of this, but for a long time, everybody has said that, well, the United States is the number one country when it comes to imprisoning people. In front of, it beats China, it beats the former Soviet states, it beats, I don't know, what's another country that people say has a lot of prisoners?
Well, we just talked about North Korea.
It beats North Korea, I think, and it, and you know, maybe that's just because it has more people to incarcerate. But we're actually number two, depending on the way you measure it, which I don't subscribe to. But technically, yes, number one is Seychelles.
Okay.
The strange thing about that is that it's such a small place. It's an island country. It's such a small place that I don't know if it's a fair comparison. But according to the NAACP from 1980 to 2008, the number of people incarcerated in America quadrupled, just from a few years.
Yeah, from roughly 500,000 to 2.3 million people behind bars,
which makes us.
Here's the biggest fact that stands out to me. The United States and its territories make up 5% of the world's population. However, we have 25% of the world's inmates.
Right, and this means that combining the number of people in prison or jail currently with the people who are under parole or probationary supervision gives us number one in every 31 adults. That's 3.2% of the population under some form of, I think the phrase that's often used is correctional control.
Yes.
That sounds kind of euphemism.
Everything from ankle bracelets up to federal penitentiary.
Mm-hmm. And of the 2.3 million incarcerated people in this country, to bring it back around, how many would you guess are African American?
Well, here is the tough truth. African Americans right now constitute nearly 1 million of the total 2.3 million incarcerated in the population.
So that's an incarceration rate nearly six times the rate of white citizens. And even though African Americans and people identifying as Hispanic or Latino make up about one quarter of the U.S. population, they comprise 58% of all prisoners, at least in 2008. So if this group, if we went by these like ethnic lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
These categories, then, if everybody was treated the way that, the current correctional system treats, white citizens, then the incarceration rate and the prison jail populations would decline by approximately 50%.
Holy crap.
It's strange. It's clearly there, and it's tragic that this often gets boiled down in the media into some sort of, dare I say it, some sort of them or us idea. When we did our video on this earlier this week, one of the things that really stuck with me was this idea that how the government or the police, because really when we're talking about the police, what we're ultimately talking about is the government that
some level of government.
Right. Some level of governance that is supposed to be for the people of the country. Right.
Mm.
But when we were doing that video, one thing that I remember clear as day is noting that how the government treats any American citizen should be the concern of every American citizen. And you know, residents as well. Like, we've heard horror stories before of foreign nationals visiting the States on vacation or to see family members and having a really, where family shows, I'll say, messed up time.
Well, it makes me think of that show Locked Up Abroad, I think is the name of it, mm-hmm. that shows you, oh, man, and this prison was so terrible in this other country and the experiences of American citizens when they were abroad.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It makes you feel like we need to have an inverted version of that somewhere. And I wonder if there is one.
There may well be. But, I'm glad that we don't live in a country that has an official death penalty for some of the things where there are countries where it's still the death penalty if you are a homosexual. It's a death penalty if you get caught with any kind of marijuana.
Yeah.
Well, that's a different podcast. And one thing that we're running into when we look at this idea is that we're finding strings that connect to other things, some of which we've covered, like the idea of privatized prisons, some of which we haven't, like is there a purposeful churn to the cycle of poverty, right? We looked at income inequality. That might be a different question.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's time for us to talk about the arguments or the allegations of conspiracy here. Like the media is making out these cases of unarmed black men being shot to be more than they are. That's one of the arguments. And they talk about the bias in reporting.
Okay, I can kind of see this situation where the media, you know, when a tragedy like this happens, it is a story. It is not only a tragedy, it is also a story. And it is something that can keep a 24-hour news cycle going for a long time,
mm-hmm.
because there are a lot of different parts. There's the initial investigation. There's the trial. There's all the things that happen and splinter off because of that. I can see how maybe in today's world where there are just hundreds of news channels and websites and vlogs and podcasts mm-hmm. like ours even that will take something like the Michael Brown case and would expand it out into this huge thing
mm-hmm.
when really, you know, at the crux of it, it was a man that got shot by a law enforcement officer.
In the case of Michael Brown specifically, this is the young man who was shot by an officer named Darren Wilson in Ferguson, a suburb in Missouri, around August 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we found is, you know, Ferguson became the site of protest, and the U.S. government came down pretty hard to the point where the airspace was controlled. There were all kinds of rumors flying back and forth about what the police may or may not be doing. And we really saw the potential for how much power a government can bring to bear on the people if it wishes.
Yes. And we also saw, you know, the reaction of a whole group of people there that were protesting because they saw something that they thought was a pattern that actually seems to be a pattern. Did you see some of the leaks that were not leaks, but some of the information coming out about the Ferguson Police Department?
Ferguson is, at least from this perspective, for what we're talking about, a bad place to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there were pretty good statistics that indicated even in areas where a black person would be by far the minority mm-hmm. in this situation, they were also by far more likely to be pulled over, to be detained, to have the threat of use of force,
mm-hmm.
right? And there was one statistic where the findings indicated that white members of the community were more likely to be driving with guns or something,
yes.
driving with unlicensed guns or something.
And carrying drugs.
So yeah, that's the one. And far less likely to be pulled over. This is something that leads people on the other side to say, on the other side of the argument to say the government is actively working to suppress black America, especially males.
And unfortunately, this has historically at least been the case.
Slavery.
Jim Crow laws.
Right. Arguably the prison system today, especially with the use of contracted out labor, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but voting rights restrictions.
Voting rights restrictions. Yeah. You cannot vote if you are a felon. So what this leads us to is, and you know, again, we'll say police are people too. They're often constrained by top-down rules. And one of the arguments that you'll hear in favor, or maybe as a mitigating factor for police, is that they're frequently put in fight or flight situations. These are life and death things where seconds really can make the difference. With that being said, there's a question here that ties into militarization of police. Are the current training tactics, the hardware and the vehicles that are being increasingly distributed to domestic law enforcement places, are they teaching these professionals or training these professionals rather to see every citizen as a potential threat?
And lethal force. A lot of the weaponry and systems that are being provided for these police departments are based upon lethal force. Unless you look at some of the, like the tactical, not it's not LRAD system, but it's the sound. I forget the name of it, but it's the
The sonic pain thing.
Yeah,
it makes you feel like your skin is on fire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the one that just has that really piercing, loud sound that we saw in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes you wonder how much more non-lethal force could be used. However, on the other side, again, if you're going in with non-lethal force against somebody who is, you know, going to attack a police officer with lethal force, I mean, what do you do there?
Well, those non-lethal weapons, you know, they're non-lethal asterisk, right?
Yeah, unless you're, you know, ill or have a bad heart or
sure.
old.
Yeah, they're definitely still weapons, and those are for crowd control more than an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But this brought up some questions that we had for you out there listening. What do you think about this racial discrepancy in law enforcement, in sentencing? What do you think the future of the police and race in America is going to be? Mm-hmm. You know, Matt, this makes me think of some interesting stuff, because remember we did net neutrality recently,
mm-hmm.
and we had so many letters from you guys saying, well, net neutrality or this open internet order is just a backdoor version of SOPA,
mm-hmm.
which was, what was SOPA, Matt?
SOPA was something that did get passed by the House of Representatives a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
At least I think, I can't remember if it was SOPA or PIPA, the one was passed by House and then shut down by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was failed legislation that was going to do a lot of things to control the internet. And it was mostly for corporations, to benefit corporations, and then also for the government to have control over the internet if they needed it.
So we received some letters about this, saying, you know, arguing that the open internet order was essentially a Trojan horse. And then it makes me wonder if we could find a future where the answer to discrepancy or prejudice in law enforcement would be something like robot police, right? Robotic police who have some sort of access to your history already and can objectively make a decision about, you know, if you're breaking a law. Or what about pre-crime? What about using big data to predict the future, which is something we're going to be talking about later?
I think that's something we're going to see whether we like it or not, whether
yeah.
or not it's actually effective.
Uh-huh.
I guess we'll find out by the statistics that will be made up.
Yeah, it reminds me of Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, where this guy named Seldon invents something he calls psychohistory. And the idea is that if you take a large enough population size, you can begin to predict the future. And it doesn't work for individuals, right? Too many variables.
Only works for big systems.
Only works for big systems, exactly. And I wonder if we could be in that kind of situation, if that will be what is presented as a solution to what is a real problem.
But with pre-crime, Ben, we've talked about this before. If you arrest someone for a crime they were imminently going to commit,
mm-hmm.
there is no way to prove that they were actually going to commit that crime. Even if you have data showing that they most likely or with probability would have committed the crime.
until there is a legal precedent set. Then after
then
that,
it will be legal. Yeah.
It's Katie bar the door. Yeah.
Or if there, we can somehow buffer reality. So there's like a 10-minute buffer on real time where this system operates 10 minutes in the future. I'm sorry. I'm just.
I mean, if that was, if that's possible, then one thing human history has shown us is that the first thing people will do is use it as some kind of snooze button. It won't be used effectively. It'll be like an extra 10 minutes to sleep.
I'm cool with that.
Yeah, I'm cool with it too. So we've delved into statistics and some facts and some statements and some analysis. And one of the most devilishly difficult things about this, again, was that there was so little comprehensive data. You know, we've got little pieces of the pie. We've got little pieces of the puzzle. But if there is some group or institution, you know, maybe the NSA, hi guys, if you're listening, if they're tracking, building a comprehensive database of these sorts of offenses, then it's something that needs to be out in the public eye. People need to know.
Yeah, but how effective is it if it's in the public eye, Ben?
I don't know. I mean, we should take a road trip to Utah.
Let's do it. So, everyone, we want to hear from you. Are you a law enforcement officer and have experience with this type of stuff? Please write to us. We would love to get some perspective. Also, if you've had run-ins with law enforcement and you want to tell us about that, please do. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We're Conspiracy Stuff on both of those. And that's the end of this classic episode. If you have any thoughts or questions about this episode, you can get into contact with us in a number of different ways. One of the best is to give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. If you don't want to do that, you can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.